Welcome back to Midpoint, friends, on September 24th, 2025. I'm your host, Shelley Reback, and we are your mid-morning, mid-week, mid-Florida source for news and public affairs. Before we get to our topic of this week, our First Amendment roundtable with my guests, all First Amendment lawyers, I want to comment on the topic of last week. You'll recall that last week we talked about vaccines with my guests, Dr. Tom Unash, an infectious disease specialist, and Dr. Neil Manamala, the president-elect of the Hillsborough County Medical Association. We only touched on the vaccines and autism issue before we ran out of time, but then, lo and behold, Trump and RFK Jr., you know, our Reich's Minister of Health, the guy with the worm in his brain, they decided to make a major public announcement about autism. And in their unsubstantiated view, that's unsubstantiated according to the best, most qualified scientific minds to date, they suggested that autism is caused not by vaccines, but by Tylenol, acetaminophen, or paracetamol, that over-the-counter drug that lowers high fevers when it's taken by mothers during pregnancy. Mamas, if you're listening and you have a child on the autism spectrum, don't for 1 minute accept that gaslighting and that guilt that they are slinging. First, the science just isn't there on that accusation. Second, a mother's high fever in pregnancy can cause fetal death. And just when the only approved medication to bring down a fever in pregnancy and prevent death is Tylenol, remember that by taking it, you saved your child's life. And third, how dare they insinuate that a child's possible death is preferable to being born healthy and neurodivergent? Autism spectrum mamas, listen up. All your kids are perfect just the way they are. Oh, and fourth, as in all things, whatever they say should be taken with an overdose of skepticism, because it is always about the grift. In this instance, it just so happens that the largest distributor of the drug that they now claim can treat autism, Leucovorin, is a company in which Dr. Mehmet Oz is a large investor. Yep, Dr. Oz, the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, stands to profit mightily from the FDA approval of this drug. The grift and corruption just never ends with these people. But their willingness to scapegoat mothers for fun and profit is just unconscionable. I also want to apologize. Unfortunately, last week I didn't have time to share with you or with my guests a number of messages that we received late in the show that all said something like, quote, "My kid or my friend's kid got the MMR vaccine, and shortly after that, they caught autism," close quote. That's how it was framed. They caught autism, like it's an infectious disease. It isn't. I got about 4 or 5 messages like that last week, and I thought they deserved a response. So I shared them with my guests after the broadcast, and again, they responded that the research on this is clear, that there's no causal connection between vaccines and autism, and it isn't transmittable. According to Dr. Unash, this is an example of correlation versus causation. It's a simple explanation. Kids are generally receiving the MMR vaccine at the same age as when some kids typically begin to display neurodivergent behaviors. So people correlate those events and assume that they mean there's a causal relationship. But there isn't. The correlation doesn't mean the behaviors are caused by the vaccine. I saw a meme the other day that put it pretty well. It said, "We know 85% of people in car crashes ate cereal that day for breakfast, but eating cereal does not cause crashes. We know this. Correlation is not causation." Okay, please be advised. I'm not taking more comments on this issue of vaccines this week, as we are on to an entirely new topic. So please, don't at me. And that means you too, Chris in Clearwater. We are not debating this. In other news, not a week goes by that I don't bring you some new abomination promulgated by Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer. This week's development on the road to Florida fascism is his creation of an online web portal through which people can report calls for violence or threats of violence that they hear or observe. Uthmeyer tied the creation of the portal, which is titled Combating Violent Extremism, to the killing earlier this month of conservative Christian right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. And Uthmeyer referred to other acts of political violence, although, color me surprised, the list he gave in his remarks completely omitted the violent acts of any right-wing extremists. Uthmeyer said reports to the portal, which might include videos, images, or text messages, will be investigated in collaboration with law enforcement. Uthmeyer also said he respects the First Amendment, which includes the right to free speech. But, he said, there's a big difference when it comes to a threat of violence, a call for violence that is not protected by the First Amendment. This all follows the comments of Tampa's own Reichsminister of Justice, Pam Bondi, who, following the assassination of Charlie Kirk, made a series of public statements regarding hate speech that triggered widespread backlash and legal criticism. On a podcast, Bondi stated, "There's free speech and then there's hate speech, and there is no place in our society for the latter." She added that her Justice Department would absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech. And as a result of her statements, there was significant backlash, with critics on the left and right pointing out that U.S. law does not recognize a hate speech exception to the First Amendment, which protects even offensive or hateful expression. In a separate interview, Bondi also suggested that the Justice Department could prosecute businesses for discriminating against customers based on their political views. She cited an incident involving an Office Depot employee who refused to print memorial flyers for Charlie Kirk. "We can prosecute you for that," Bondi said. But legal commentators also questioned this assertion, noting it could conflict with Supreme Court precedents like Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, which involved a baker who refused to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Then, facing mounting criticism, Bondi attempted to clarify her remarks. She later stated on X or Twitter that, quote, "Hate speech that crosses the line into threats of violence is not protected by the First Amendment. It's a crime." She also cited some specific statutes related to threats of violence, including threats against public officials and doxing. But despite Bondi's clarification, legal experts maintain that her initial statements failed to accurately reflect First Amendment law, which protects most speech unless it constitutes a, quote, "true threat" or, quote, "incitement to imminent lawless action," close quote. Quote. Experts noted that the standard for incitement is extremely narrow. It's established by the Supreme Court in a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio from 1969, and that much of what Bondi and other officials described would not meet this high legal bar of an incitement to imminent lawless action. Oh, poor Stetson Law School, its educators, and all its alumni. Pam is doing real damage to your reputation for legal education, isn't she? The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression and the ACLU also expressed alarm over the broader rhetoric from the administration, which they say encourages retaliation against private individuals for their political commentary. Following Bondi's statements, many private and public employees who made comments about Kirk's death reportedly faced termination or suspension or other consequences. And that's what we are going to be talking about today in our First Amendment Roundtable with my guests, attorney Ryan Barrick, who primarily represents employees in disputes with management, including claims of violation of civil rights. Happy to have you here, Ryan.
Thank you, Shelley. Happy to be here.
And attorney James Shaw Jr., former chair of the legal panel of the ACLU of Florida. I'm glad you're here, James.
Thank you, Shelley. Thanks for having me.
And attorney Tiffany Hilton, former vice president of the ACLU of Florida Board of Directors. Welcome, Tiffany.
Good morning. It's an honor.
Okay. I welcome your calls and comments, listeners, on these First Amendment issues. Also, you can join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. We'd especially like to hear from any of you if you have been threatened by your employer over anything you've said about the death of Charlie Kirk or otherwise. Tell us about it. Let's start with you, Ryan. We've all heard about Disney, a private company, suspending Jimmy Kimmel. They brought him back, by the way, last night. And about the teachers in Pinellas County and elsewhere. I think there's more than a dozen of them around Florida as of Monday. And tenured faculty at Florida public universities who have been placed on administrative leave and are under investigation for comments they've made about Charlie Kirk's death. Disney's a private company, and the schools are essentially a government entity. So my question is, are the First Amendment issues different for employees, whether they work for the government or for a private employer?
The First Amendment issues are different depending on who the employer is. For a employer who works for a government entity, the courts look at what they call the Pickering test, which is a balance where you have to balance the employee's interests with speaking about a matter of public concern with the employer's interest in having the efficient operation of government. So it's a different test. For somebody who works for a private employer, in most situations, if the private employer on their own doesn't like what the employee's saying, they could terminate them. Where things get really sort of funky is where you have the president specifically calling out the speech and then having his other people associated with the administration specifically calling out the speech and then using the power of the FCC to try and target that speech. That's a very different, very bizarre circumstance that's not like what we typically see in private employment.
So what if somebody has an employment contract and it says they can only be fired or disciplined for cause? Is speech that is antithetical to the position of the company on political issues cause?
If an employer had a cause contract, it might be. It really depends on sort of, again, it would be a balancing, I think, what the employee said versus what the employer's interests were. If the employer is a government contractor, that might impact it. If the employee is sort of saying outrageous things, then that might impact on whether or not that represents cause under that contract.
Well, I know that this past week there was a case out of the 11th Circuit that involved a guy who was a farmer who sold fruits and vegetables to Lee County School System, who back when COVID was brand new, was making statements that COVID was a hoax. And his contract to sell fruits and vegetables was terminated by Lee County, and he sued claiming that his termination was a violation of his First Amendment rights and that he had a right to say that COVID was a hoax. The 11th Circuit, I think, came out and said, well, yeah, he could say what he wants, but we are treating this as a public safety issue, as the school system did, right?
Well, the interesting thing about that case was the court really focused on the fact that they weren't fulfilling the contractual obligations. So they were supposed to have COVID protocols in place. They were supposed to be doing things at the facility, and they weren't doing any of those things. So the court really didn't engage on the First Amendment issues very much. It was instead treated as sort of a breach of contract. You're supposed to be doing these things, and it wasn't the fact that you were speaking out against the COVID protocols. It was that you weren't actually doing them and you were contractually obligated to do them. That's what the court focused on.
But now, thanks to DeSantis and our Surgeon General Latipo, we don't have any protocols, right? So it might be different today if that case came up today. Okay, but I want to talk about Brendan Carr, the FCC chair. I mean, because he said, and I quote, "We can do this the easy way or the hard way," close quote, like a mafioso has been the suggestion. Now, last year, there was a case, National Rifle Association versus VULO, where the Supreme Court unanimously affirmed the fundamental principle of our constitutional republic and stated government officials cannot attempt to coerce private parties in order to punish or suppress views that the government disfavors, close quote. Now, ironically, the NRA was represented in that case by the ACLU. So I want to hear from you ACLU lawyers about that. Right?
Sure.
Okay.
So
I need you to talk into the microphone loudly.
Gotcha. So, my understanding with the NRA case is that the New York Department of Financial Services told banks and insurance companies in New York not to provide services to the NRA. And the reason for that is because they lobbied in support of gun rights in the U.S. The NRA sued Vulo, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that while government officials may not use their regulatory powers to coerce individuals or entities into refraining from protected speech, government officials have a right, indeed a duty, to address issues of public concern. So I think that this case speaks to exactly what you were just talking about in relation to education, in that, the Supreme Court found that, New York State couldn't do that to the NRA because it was expressing viewpoints that the government didn't like, but that it had extended way too far. And I think that the standard probably for government employees is very, very similar. I don't think any of the teachers, I haven't seen any reports that any of them were propagating calls to actions or calls for violence. I think the Supreme Court has actually already spoken to this loud and clear.
Well, you know, how do we explain, I think it's easy to explain why all these media companies who are being sued by Trump are capitulating to him. He's basically suing them because he claims he doesn't like their speech. He's claiming it in the context of a defamation claim, but really he doesn't like what they say about him. But they're all capitulating, and it seems like they're capitulating because they all have mergers on deck that need to be approved by the government, by the FCC, right?
Yeah, that's where Trump is masterful at finding some kind of leverage that he can use over someone. What's different, what's new is I can't believe that in the history of media, this is the first time that any administration has been irked by some of what they see in the media. But up until now, no one has said we can do this the easy way or the hard way. We need to silence my critics. We've never had a president so intolerant of being mocked or laughed at. If you think about it, George H.W. Bush posed for pictures with Dana Carvey. Will Ferrell and George W. Bush got along just fine. They thought that their impressions of them were hysterical. But this president wants to silence anyone from making fun of him and will openly say that that's what he is doing. And so these mergers kind of give some leverage that if you don't offer up Jimmy Kimmel as a sacrifice to me, then maybe that merger won't get approved.
Yeah, and supposedly the story is that Trump decided to run for president after he was mocked by Barack Obama at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner years ago, right?
If you watch that video, my father is convinced that that was the moment it happened.
Yeah.
You can see the rage welling up in his eyes and the decision being made right there that I am going to run for president and I'm going to undo everything you did.
Yeah, I think that that's probably accurate. The man has no sense of humor. Let's just agree with that. But let's talk about the Jimmy Kimmel situation a little bit. On Monday, the ACLU released an open letter condemning Disney's decision that was signed by over 400 Hollywood stars, including Jennifer Aniston, Ben Affleck, Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, and Robert De Niro, who was on Jimmy Kimmel's show last night playing Brendan Carr, impersonating him as if he was a mafioso on Jimmy Kimmel's show when he came back last night. All of those 400 Hollywood stars, big names and small, signed the ACLU's letter. And then Snopes said, which is the fact-checking site, said that calculations revealed that overnight, after Jimmy Kimmel got suspended, Disney's market capitalization fell by $1.4 billion. However, by the end of the week, it had dropped to $4.2 billion. And the next week, on September 22nd, Disney's valuation had dropped by $6.4 billion. And while this tumble was leaked to the backlash against the company for the decision to remove Jimmy's show, it seems to have been reversed due to financial considerations. I mean, power to the people, right? I mean, this is one of the things that has proven to be very effective in fighting back against some of these things that the Trump administration is doing. When the people get together, whether it's in big protest or more likely using the power of the purse, that the government seems to back off. And as we know, Jimmy Kimmel was back on the air last night. I mean, it's not really a First Amendment issue to recognize that a lot of these decisions are about money. But there you have it, right?
Yeah, I think it is an interesting issue, and it does show that when consumers get together, they have the ability to impact decisions. Now, the First Amendment sort of issue, it becomes interesting when people claim that, oh, consumers getting together is violating their rights. You've heard Elon Musk sort of jump up and down about the fact that businesses and groups come together, and when they're opposing something that he does, getting together like that and trying to bring a claim associated with that.
Or protesting in front of Tesla, or not buying Teslas, or urging others not to buy Teslas.
Exactly. And people have a First Amendment right to spend their money or not spend their money, and to boycott brands and ideas that they don't like. So people dropping their Disney cancellations or canceling their Disney subscriptions, I mean, that's a First Amendment action, right? They're making a decision about where it is they want to consume, what it is they want to do based upon their own values. And we should protect that and endorse that.
Yeah, right? I mean, the government does have the power, for example, to take away an FCC license. You know, we worry about that at WMNF constantly, frankly. I'm the biggest danger to the WMNF FCC license, I think. And, you know, Trump has expressed the fact that he wants the IRS to come after these advocacy groups and activist groups and take away their tax-exempt status, their business licenses, their FCC licenses in the case of broadcast entities like WMNF. I mean, we need to have a giant First Amendment legal defense war chest for precisely these reasons, because, I mean, if we lose our tax exempt status and we have to pay tax, I mean, that's a lot of money. If we lose our FCC license, we have to find other ways of getting into your ears. It's become pretty critical for places like WMNF. So just keep that in mind when you tune in now and you tune in to 88.5, or you're on your computer, you go to WMNF.org. We're easy to find. That may not always be the case. All right. I want to talk about another First Amendment issue that has come up just this week. And I don't think it's been getting enough attention. And that's the issue involving our Reich's Minister of Defense. Oops, I mean our Reich's Minister of War now, Pete Hegseth. He has announced that he will now force reporters to pledge not to gather or to use any information that had not been formally authorized for release, including not classified information, or else the reporter will lose their credential to cover the military. The National Press Club has called this a direct assault on independent journalism. This follows the White House's regime's limiting access to certain news outlets. Remember, they wouldn't let the AP cover the White House because of the position that AP took on reporting the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of Mexico instead of Trump's preferred nomenclature, the Gulf of America. So the White House regime's been limiting access to news outlets because of coverage it doesn't like. And Trump has himself sued, as we talked about, numerous news organizations over their coverage. Now, just this week, United States District Court Judge Stephen Maraday here in Tampa dismissed Trump's over 85-page complaint against the New York Times, saying it was defective because it wasn't a brief statement of the facts and the law. It was more of a PR or propaganda document. I don't know why Trump decided to file that case here in the Middle District of Florida. I don't know what particular jurisdiction he thought, why he thought this was a more favorable jurisdiction to file it in than New York City, for example. I guess he thinks...
Well, there's
a resident, right?
Well, he's a resident of South Florida. I mean, I think that
that's a different district from the middle. That's right. Southern District of Florida.
I mean, for what it's worth, I think it represents a lack of understanding of who the district judges are in the Middle District Tampa Division. There happen to be more Republican judges nominated by Republican presidents in the Middle District of Florida Tampa Division than other districts. And I think that he thought, well, just because someone was nominated by a Republican president, they're necessarily going to rule for him.
And a bunch of them were nominated by him.
Right. And nonetheless, that doesn't mean that they're going to rule for him. I think that those judges Judge Maraday, for example, looked at the complaint. And Judge Maraday, I think, is someone who is known for being a stickler for the rules and being very mindful of having people comply with the rules. And you have something that is obviously non-compliant with the rules. And he just simply said, this isn't how we do things here. We don't draft 85-page complaints for what should be a much more straightforward allegations.
I've got a call. We're going to get back to this in a second, but I've got a call here that I want to take. Jessica Vaughn is the chair of the Hillsborough County School Board, and she's on the line with us. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for being here. Thanks, you all, for the work that you do to make sure that, you know, we're protecting our workers and free speech. As the chair of the school board, I know you briefly touched on it, but I'm just curious. I saw that they've already suspended the teaching certificate of one of our teachers for what they say is improper language on social media about Charlie Kirk. And, you know, they've referenced a statute that basically says that there are higher expectations from teachers regarding their conduct on social media. And I just wanted to get your feedback for whether you think that violates, you know, their constitutional rights, and whether if teachers are in that situation, they have a viable lawsuit if their teaching certificates are being suspended over their social media posts.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for the call. I think that one of the issues we confront is it can be fact specific, right? So it depends to some degree on what it is the teacher has said. The courts, interestingly, focus on what it said and where it said. And it's really sort of a balancing test. And so if you have somebody who is speaking in a private conversation, those conversations are generally going to be entitled to more protection. The more public the statement is, the less protection it's going to get. And the more over the top the statement is, the less protection it's going to get. So, you know, there are some cases out there. There were a number of cases early on in the early 2020s involving police officers and doing things like flying the Confederate flag at their house. And the courts generally found that that was not a protected activity for a police officer to be flying a Confederate flag at their house.
Not a protected activity. That means that the police officer could be disciplined or fired or...
That's right.
Okay.
And so, because again, there's this notion that police officers are engaged in higher... There's a higher... notion of what it is they should be saying. It's a very public act, and it becomes a focus on what it is. There's an older case where somebody made a comment about Reagan when he was shot and said to a coworker, if they go for him, I hope they get him, associated with the Reagan potential assassination. And the Supreme Court said, well, that's a First Amendment speech because it was a private conversation. It wasn't something that, and it wasn't as outrageous. And so you end up with this sort of interesting balance about, is are comments that are made on social media really public, or are they only comments that are being made to a much a smaller universe, and how outrageous are the comments?
I don't know, Jessica, whether there are policies that teachers are informed about when they are hired that say what they can and cannot say for on social media, or whether or not they can say it during school hours versus out of school hours. I mean, those are all things that the school system should probably have a policy about. I'm not saying what the policy should be, but there should be a policy so that teachers are put on notice about what the school system will accept in that regard.
And so there is a there are policies, and they get continual training. They, you know, I just had a teacher reach out to me that talked about the training they got over the summer from the state, but it's subjective. You know, terms like appropriate conduct, as you know, as lawyers, is subjective to the court's understanding of the law. I did have one follow-up question, though. There seems to be a similar statute in place for elected officials as far as how they conduct themselves and what they say. And we see situations where you have, you know, members like Randy Fine who talk about, you know, killing all sorts of people. And I'm just wondering, you know, who is responsible for holding elected officials accountable to the same standards that we're looking at holding police officers or teachers to?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, if you look at DeSantis's spokeswoman,
Christina Pushaw.
Yeah, is notorious for just saying very, very inflammatory things. I think that's a good point, though, because it suggests that as a state, there are things that we think are appropriate and tolerable. So if we're going to say it's appropriate and tolerable for the spokesperson to say sort of these things, well, why would we think that it wasn't appropriate for someone else to make those sorts of statements if the only difference is the political frame within which it's being made? That would suggest that it is absolutely focused on just the viewpoint that's being expressed.
But isn't there also a legislative immunity clause about if somebody says something from the dais in the course of legislating something, that they're protected?
Well, absolutely. And the 11th Circuit case involving Andrew Warren, although it ultimately took them forever to get there, the 11th Circuit decision on the Andrew Warren case is actually pretty helpful for public employees and their right to speak and to speak about issues of public concern. You know, they took so long to sort it out, and then the silliness with the Florida Supreme Court was another problem. But at least on that issue, there is a decent holding.
Well, also, though, there's that banned book case out of Orlando where, you know, the issue was government speech. Like, is it appropriate for the government to have a perspective that's protected over and above the public, you know, like librarians who want to put certain books in school libraries that the government entity believes is inconsistent with government speech? I mean, that whole concept of government speech being protected is new. And I'm not sure that it really holds up against the First Amendment, because the First Amendment is very explicit that it's protection for citizens or outside entities outside of the government. It protects you from government coercion about your speech. So to suggest that government speech itself requires protection, I don't understand that. You know, that doesn't seem to be within the ambit of the First Amendment.
Sure. What I think Jessica was saying, hi, Jessica, by the way. What I think Jessica was kind of alluding to, though, is that what has changed is there used to be some kind of self-regulation on the part of the government. There used to be this feeling of, well, I'm annoyed by what was said, but I'm not going to actually try to fire this teacher. Because when Ryan says it's a fact-driven inquiry, what us lawyers know that that means is you would have to litigate this, and somebody would have to hire a defense attorney or an attorney to bring a wrongful termination suit and pay that attorney by the hour and spend $100,000 to save a $55,000 a year job, which not everybody's going to be able to do. And so we do rely to a much greater degree than we realized on the self-restraint of the government to not put us in that position in the first place. But when you mentioned Andrew Warren, I think that was a situation where most of the legal minds of Florida thought that the governor couldn't do that. And he probably thought that he couldn't do that, but he was just going to do it anyways. And what's Andrew Warren going to do about it? And maybe procedurally he won't be able to right this wrong, and he ultimately was not able to do that. That's new. That's always been part of who Donald Trump was. He's brought defamation suits against people his whole life, not because he thought he was going to win them, but because he wanted to make them have to spend their life savings.
He made statements
themselves.
How he's going to sue ABC now because they brought Jimmy Kimmel back. He said, they paid me $16 million before, and I think this suit's going to get me even more, or words to that effect.
But he doesn't really care if he wins or loses the suit. It's a way that he coerces you into complying with what he'd like you to do.
Right.
Well,
right.
And I think this goes back to your capitulation point as well. People just don't want to take on the fight. If you lose your job and you're a teacher, even if you are willing to spend the $100,000 or you have it, or even if you have somebody pro bono to represent you, right? How many years of litigation is that? And how much irreparable harm is done? And perhaps that teacher's lost their health insurance, their whole family's lost their health insurance as a result. It's just a domino effect, you know? But I think people are capitulating in all aspects because they don't want to deal with it. And that's how they keep getting away with these things that we don't think they can do. It's that as a whole, we're allowing them. But I think people are just unsure exactly how to get together and affect change.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this Jimmy Kimmel thing, though, has really needs to be held up as an example of exactly that, how people can get together and affect change. I mean, when it's one teacher standing alone at risk, or somebody like Jessica, the chair of the school board, standing alone, making it known that she feels coerced to vote a certain way on these book banning things. You know, when it's one person alone, it's very difficult for that one person to stand up and take that risk, take that bullet for everybody else. But when people get together, and, you know, they either use their pocketbook, or they use their vote, or they use their bodies in protest, or what have you, you know, then all of a sudden we have seen the government back down, right? You know, so yeah. I think that's the lesson here. I don't know. Jessica, thank you so much for calling in with those great questions.
So I appreciate it. Take care.
All right. And if you have some questions or comments about these First Amendment issues, particularly if you yourself have had experience being threatened because of statements that you've made, either by your workplace or otherwise, you can join our conversation by calling us at 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. We are here with some ACLU lawyers and a lawyer who represents employees in civil rights matters. And, you know, we would love to hear from you, too. So I do have one email here that I wanted to share because apparently this is one of the main issues is when people do speak out, it's not just a First Amendment issue. When they're attacked by the government, it seems to be stimulating reactions from the public, and it puts them in danger, you know? I mean, we are unfortunately living in a very volatile and violent society right now, and people are being threatened over their speech by vigilante groups. One of the big issues that I wanted to talk about today is that Uthmeyer, like I said earlier, has started this website, this portal, for people to report hate speech, essentially, what he deems to be hate speech. That's going to be a matter of public record that people will be able to see, right? I mean, in Florida, we have the Sunshine Law. So if people post things on this website and they name names, you know, there are people out in the world who consider themselves sort of vigilantes who will potentially threaten that person whose name is disclosed. You know, it's more than doxing now. It's real threats of violence, and we've had that. I have an email here from one of our listeners, DeMarco, who says that he got some threats. One of them he forwarded to us, and I'm not going to use the name of the person because I don't know enough about this circumstance, but he forwarded to us a communication that he got that said, "Judging by your surname, you and your family must be worth reporting to ICE so they can come visit you to check on your citizenship status. Don't worry, I'm sure they'll only detain you for a little while they get things sorted out." And then there's a ICE tip line link there. That's the kind of thing that people who speak out are receiving from the public. And I think it's something that needs to, you know, it's of great concern. All right, I have another call here from Kenny. Kenny, you're on the air. You want to talk about the First Amendment issues?
Yes, I do, actually. Good morning. How is everybody?
Everybody's here and a little nervous, but go ahead.
No, I'm trying not to be nervous myself. I mean, it's safe to say that all three of your guests and yourself are not absolutely not Trump supporters or don't like anything that the man is actually trying to do or not trying to do, however that may be. I find it interesting that at this particular point, we decide to talk about openly the First Amendment right and the ability to express your opinion without being hateful. And that the gentleman that was actually not just a death, as you called it, his death, but assassinated is probably more of an appropriate word, that the man was actually a person that was talking with dialogue, whether we liked it or not. That is the man that was killed in front of all of America. And I think it's come to a point in America that we've all kind of gotten to a point that we're just kind of tired of it, that we really don't want to have to go with the nasty discord back and forth, that there's a better way of being able to handle situations and being able to sit down and ask people their questions and concerns and express your own opinion in a civil discord.
I think everybody would agree with you, Kenny, that there's no place for political violence or political assassination. I don't think anybody around this table would disagree with that.
Well, that's very good. I mean, obviously, I would agree with you guys as well. At any rate, I would never ever want to see anybody harmed for their own personal beliefs or feelings or how they express them. I just think it's interesting to me that it's now so prevalent that we're going to talk about, you know, basically trying to silence somebody else when for so long it was somebody trying to silence somebody else. I hate left and right. I'm kind of dead center of everybody and kind of sick of everyone. So it's one of those things. But, you know, it's just interesting to me how sides sometimes come off as hypocritical, if lack of a better word, on how things are handled and how.
All right, Kenny, I think we got your point, man. You want to have more civil dialogue. And again,
absolutely.
I don't think anybody here would disagree with you. Thanks a lot for your call, though. I appreciate you calling in and giving us your perspective.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for your topic.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that.
I wouldn't disagree with it, but I would like to provide sort of like a counterpoint, because it's very topical, that hate speech does not exist legally in America. There's ugly speech, there's gross speech, there's evil speech, and all of it is protected by the First Amendment. Keep America free. And that's a Charlie Kirk quote. We compound the tragedy of his death if we turn our backs on what he believed.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the main thing that Pam Bondi got criticized for, that she equated hate speech with illegal speech. And that's not the case. The First Amendment protects even hate speech as long as it doesn't, as long as it isn't an imminent call for violence, an imminent threat of violence.
And I know that Miss Bondi knows that because I'm a Stetson grad. Shout out to Professor Varelli. He's an amazing con law teacher. I know she knows that.
Yeah, she's given Stetson Law School a really bad name, I have to say.
I'm trying to reform it.
Okay.
But I kind of understand what Kenny was saying, though, because like, Jimmy Kimmel, for instance, if you... I think younger people don't remember it, but he used to be on this show called The Man Show, which was all misogynistic jokes, and he appeared in blackface in some sketches in the 90s. And, you know, imagine if those were to resurface and there was this sudden movement on Twitter, cancel Jimmy Kimmel for these inappropriate things he said and did in the 1990s. I think a lot of the same people who are calling for his reinstatement right now would have been, and, you know, part of the other mob saying, yeah, let's get rid of him. So there's I understand what Kenny's saying when there's a little bit of hypocrisy too, that when people say we must protect the right to free speech, you only ever hear that in connection with speech that the speaker sympathizes with. You don't hear so much somebody saying, I disagree with everything you said, but here's the microphone.
You don't, right. You don't hear Trump praising free speech for people criticizing him or any of his regime people supporting criticism. I have an email here from Sarah who says, this is Trump channeling Roy Cohen. And I think that's a really apt comparison because, you know, anybody who studies history knows that Roy Cohen was a very famous lawyer and aide to Joseph McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings. And right now we're in a position where Trump and his allies are calling for investigations that really reek of McCarthyism. They want to quash all dissent. Stephen Miller, White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, speaking on Charlie Kirk's podcast with J.D. Vance on Monday, said, with God as my witness, we are going to use every resource we have at the DOJ, Homeland Security, and throughout this government to identify, disrupt, dismantle, and destroy these networks. And he's talking about, you know, sort of progressive or left advocacy groups. The day after Charlie Kirk's death, 22 members of the House Freedom Caucus asked the speaker to create a select committee on the money, influence, and power behind what they called the radical left's assault on America and the rule of law. I mean, come on. You know, this is where we're at right now. These organizations have to worry about their status, about their IRS tax exempt status, about their FCC license, like I mentioned earlier. People are being targeted by this. I think it's very McCarthyite.
It's exactly McCarthy. There's even a shadowy organization that doesn't really exist that people are going to need to deny that they are members of, and Antifa. The Antifa is like saying hippies. It's not a real organization. There's no president of it. It's just a some kind of loosely defined movement. But there's this narrative out there that it's actually an organized group of well-funded violent leftists and they need to be stopped. And that's not true, but people are going to be investigated for potential membership in this.
Well, I have no membership card in Antifa, but I count myself as a proud member, right? And there's no law about domestic terrorist groups. There's no law like there is about foreign terrorist groups that the president can sanction. We don't have that law in the United States. So he can talk about it all he wants, but it doesn't exist.
This administration really has highlighted the glaring gaps in our system of governance and how we've just been holding it together by good faith this entire time.
All right, I've got a call from Carl in Dunedin. Carl, you're on the air. You're on the air. Carl in Dunedin, are you there? Okay, Carl, I brought you on. Now you're going off. Sorry. You can call back if we have time, although I doubt that we do. Ryan, let me ask you one more thing. What about school students? Or let me ask the ACLU lawyers. What about school students? Are their First Amendment rights any different from adults? Does it matter if their statements are made in school or out of school? Not teachers, but students. Can they be disciplined by the school, suspended, expelled, put in detention for the kind of speech that they make?
Sure. Well, I think a really good blue point for that is Mahoney Area School District VBL, which was the case in 2017 with the cheerleader that used a lot of expletives online, saying F the school because she hadn't been promoted from JV to varsity. And the Supreme Court, in an 8-1 decision, said that schools can punish some speech, even if it's outside of school, especially if it's harassing, bullying, cheating, or otherwise disruptive, because schools have a special interest in regulating some off-campus student speech. But to the contrary, the court found the speech that Ms. BL uttered is the kind of pure speech to which, were she an adult, the First Amendment would provide strong protection. So I think it goes back to the very beginning of the show when Ryan was explaining the different tests and things like that. From that Supreme Court opinion, I have the understanding that would it rise to the level of disruption, harassment, bullying, violence? Yes, the school can do it, but if it doesn't, they can't. The problem is, where's the line?
Right.
Where is the line?
So F the school was fine, according to the court.
Yes, F the school, F the cheer team, all good.
Well, okay. It wouldn't have been fine if she had yelled that into a bullhorn in the middle of a classroom in progress, because that would be disrupting the school. But she made it online on her own time, out of school.
Let me see if I can't bring Carl in very quickly. Carl, you have seconds to make your point.
Just that the process we're seeing, Stephen Miller is like Trump's Himmler.
You know, Stephen Miller, in his speech at the Charlie Kirk Memorial, was found to have plagiarized two speeches by Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's propaganda minister.
I'm starting to think he's not such a good guy.
And the American people need to know that that's what's really going on. And anyway, thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Carl. Thanks for calling back. We appreciate that. Yeah, I saw a comparison of Stephen Miller's speech with the highlights of the two Joseph Goebbels speech, and they're remarkably similar. Remarkably similar. So he is not only our Reichsminister of policy, but now our Reichsminister of propaganda as well, which is amazing. But, you know, I do want to just emphasize here at WMNF the dangers of this investigation that Stephen Miller is touting of nonprofits and groups, progressive groups, because that is a direct threat to WMNF. And if you're listening to us out there in listener land, you know that, you know, we have these fund drives coming up. We have another one coming up because, you know, we are in the position now of being at great risk of things that would cost us a lot of money to fight back against. And so I just want you to be aware of that these are the things that we worry about here at Resistance Radio. You know, will we have to defend our FCC license? Will we lose our tax-exempt status? Are we safe in this building, or do we need to invest in more security apparatus here to protect us when we're on the air? So I just want you to remember that when we ask for your support, your financial support, this is what it's for. Our free speech war chest, which is more necessary than ever in our 46-year history. That's about all we have time for today. I want to thank my guests, the attorneys, Ryan Barrick of EmployeeRights.com.
Thank you, Shelley.
And James Shaw, former chair of the Florida ACLU legal panel.
Thanks for having me, Shelley.
And Tiffany Hilton, formerly of the ACLU board of directors.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate you coming and talking with us about free speech issues. It's an ongoing conversation that we're going to continue, at least for the rest of my tenure here. If you'd like to support our free speech here at WMNF, please contribute to WMNF.org. And please, if you are so inclined and you appreciate this show, direct your contribution to Midpoint so we can keep bringing you our independent news and public affairs and our righteous commentary. Thanks also to our WMNF volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. Now stay tuned for Duncan and Talking Animals. We are